This week on Your Western Context, Trudeau's small business subsidy actually went to large corporations. Alberta's budget forecasts a surplus and investment, while BC's budget forecasts a deficit and more taxes. Also, Trudeau's new digital services tax faces backlash from the U.S. This is Western Context, episode 258, recorded Friday, February 25th, 2022. A Tale of Two Budgets. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are here, as we have been for each and every week, going back to January of 2017, and we're going to bring you the news of the week that's not being talked about in the mainstream media, and we're going to remove some bias and sensationalism along the way.
Yes, exactly, with, of course, the news being on world affairs this past week with the ongoing tensions in Ukraine and Russia. There's a lot of stories that happened right in our own country here that affect Canadians quite deeply that really haven't got the coverage that they deserve from a distracted media that's focused on other things.
Yeah, and of course, the horrible invasion of Ukraine by Russia is something that we could have talked about from the various stances that all of the political leaders have made in Canada, from the federal government itself imposing sanctions to some very strong language coming out of Alberta Premier Jason Kenney on natural resources and energy relating to what the Biden administration is up to. We've decided this week to focus on news stories that were not covered because of all the coverage that was talked about in the mainstream media with Ukraine and Russia. And this is what Western Context has been about. It's been about finding these stories that aren't talked about, or finding the stories that have a little bit of misinformation, missing context, and bias and sensationalism included in all of them. And we strive to remove all that bias and sensationalism. And that's what we've been doing since the very beginning here at Western Context. And along the way, hopefully, we'll provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we're going to start with a Canada story talking about how the small business relief program might not have actually went to small businesses.
Yes, and it's undeniable that the last 2 years have been tough for Canadian businesses, and with enduring lockdown restrictions that have closed many across Canada for long stretches of time, often with no rhyme or reason, well, many of them have been forced to either close permanently or at the very least reduce their hours, staff, or their stock, or what they're actually able to do. Now, in order to offset these problems that the pandemic had caused, the Canadian government set aside a $100 billion subsidy specifically for small businesses to be able to offset some of those challenges. And now we're starting to see just how ineffective that program actually was, because instead of helping out small businesses as intended, it instead bankrolled large corporations, many of which are, of course, the direct competition to those smaller businesses in the first place. Now, according to Statistics Canada data that was disclosed earlier this week, large corporations were actually three times as likely as small businesses to receive the Canada Emergency Wage Subsidy. Now, the Statistics Canada report says that, quote, smallest businesses have the lowest usage rates. Less capital-intensive small businesses may have lower fixed costs than more capital-intensive larger businesses. Thus, it may be better for the smallest businesses to close rather than to continue operating. And yes, that is Statistics Canada saying that they think that, well, larger corporations can handle getting more of the money and it would fix more problems, and those small businesses should just close. We don't need to worry about them. So this is from the official government department that's actually handling all the statistics surrounding the finances. Now, back in March of 2020, which was, of course, a very challenging time as we didn't know what was going to happen in the future, Parliament passed Bill C-13, which was an act respecting certain measures in response to COVID-19, and this was part of it was to offer a 10% wage subsidy to small businesses facing insolvency. And Prime Minister Justin Trudeau at the time said that the program was crucial for small businesses. On April 27th of the same year of 2020, he said, quote, right across the country, it's going to keep businesses and workers connected. That gives people certainty that they will have a job now and in the months to come. But now, fast forward just a little under 2 years later, we now know how little help throwing money at the problem actually was, because we have stats now as to who actually benefited from the program. Only 29% of small operators with fewer than 5 employees actually received subsidies under the program, and 13% of small businesses in Canada closed during this 2-year period. And by comparison, 61% of large corporations with more than 100 employees had received the subsidies, with only 2% of them closing. Now, the program paid $100.2 billion in subsidies to just under 460,000 businesses across Canada by official estimate. Now, the rules with the program actually allowed payments to publicly traded corporations that issued shareholder dividends and Canadian subsidiaries of foreign corporations. And this included companies such as the Bank of China, the Habib Bank of Pakistan, and the Shinhan Bank of South Korea. So this means that Canadian taxpayer money was actually being diverted to foreign banks for really no reason at all. So now we actually see that spending billions of taxpayer money on small businesses was actually just going to fund those who really didn't need it. The largest corporations that were able to weather the storm better, as well as foreign companies and multinationals. So once again, in Trudeau's Canada, we see a policy that is specifically designed to benefit the rich off the backs of the working poor and the middle class. Now, meanwhile, small businesses across the country are looking forward to the light at the end of the tunnel in the form of the end of restrictions. Now, all provinces except for BC and New Brunswick have tabled plans to end their restrictions in the coming month or so. Hannah Kovacs, who is a Halifax fitness gym operator who was forced to close 3 different times, says it bluntly. She said, quote, can we take what we've learned from the past 2 years to make policies that aren't devastating for small businesses? We need to find a way forward. We can't be asked to sacrifice and take on more debt again. Now, this has made it to our quote of the week because it really just says in plain terms what went wrong with small businesses over the past couple of years and how things need to change going forward should COVID continue to have an impact on our economy. Now, Louis-Philippe Gauthier, who is the Senior Director of Legislative Affairs with the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses in Atlantic Canada, which is certainly quite a mouthful, well, he agrees with Kovacs' statement. He says that businesses are cautiously optimistic about reopening plans, but that many are worried about a potential fresh round of restrictions if a new wave comes along. He says, quote, we can't keep on slamming the brakes on businesses and their operations. Capacity restrictions are just choking off businesses. So as restrictions lift, Gauthier says that it will take time to rebuild consumer confidence. Another round of lockdowns would decimate the hard-won gains of small businesses. He says, quote, we need to find other solutions and apply new ways of dealing with this if cases rise. We're going to have some more real casualties in the business world if we keep pumping the brakes on and off. So whatever happens in the future, it's up to our federal government to ensure that small businesses aren't being left behind. They are vital to further innovation and market competitiveness. And if large corporations are soaking up the taxpayer money instead, it doesn't really benefit consumers either. Because with our recent inflation crisis that the government has also really done little about, more competition is what is needed, not putting Canada further into debt for little benefit.
And this is part of why the whole discussion on pandemic restrictions has become so polarized in this country, because everybody who was involved with a small business or was part of a small business or saw what was happening with the larger corporations through the first half of the pandemic or so, where you could look at the same street and you could see places like a Costco or Walmart that were allowed to run, but your local corner store or local grocery stores would in effect be shut down. because of a restriction or even extended out further to even talk about services that were being rendered by local businesses, because that's who renders most services in a city. It's going to be small businesses. And this has just caused a lot of the strife that we've seen throughout the pandemic. And now that we have the numbers, we can say that this was actually happening as people were feeling it was happening. That was the collective mood through most of 2020, is that the government said they were bringing in these things to help, but there was a good portion of that aid that was actually going to these large corporations. Now we have the data to back that up. And this is something that when the House of Commons resumes in a week and a bit, that the NDP and the Conservatives definitely need to hammer the government on when it comes to question period days.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like this story has completely flown under the radar. I believe it was only really reported in the Ottawa Sun. It didn't even appear in any other publications across Canada. And you kind of have to read between the lines of little small stories here and there about what is actually happening with small businesses in Canada, which really do impact quite a bit going forward on Canadians, because small businesses are the ones that will innovate and be able to provide competition for those bigger businesses. And oftentimes they'll have better quality of goods as well, as they specialize in more things. You can't just go to your Walmarts or your Bay or, you know, any other big department stores and expect to find everything that you need, because oftentimes a lot of the small businesses will have exactly what it is you're looking for. And with less and less of them being able to stay open, that means there's going to be less and less goods available, but also it means that there's not going to be as much competition for pricing, which, as we see with inflation going up and up and up over the past year or so, or especially in the last few months, we're seeing more and more problems around that, where there isn't as much competition and there's little incentive for people to actually keep their prices low when they know that there's nowhere else to go to get them. And I think regardless of what kind of store that is, whether it's a gas station or a department store or a grocery store, really there's more competition is what is needed. So we're finally seeing some data surrounding the programs from the earliest days of the pandemic. And, well, we're not really seeing how they're actually helping Canadians going forward. And when it comes down to it, that's $100 billion. Some of it probably did go to where it should have gone, but quite a large amount of it didn't. And I think that's something that we need going forward, is more accountability for what happens in government and what they're actually doing to benefit Canadians. Because what we're seeing from this is something that didn't really get much coverage in the media, didn't really receive much coverage in the House of Commons either, because they're, of course, focused on the bigger stories. But this is something that will impact Canadians going forward. And, you know, this is an important one to talk about.
Yeah, anybody who was critical of restrictions or even people who are on the fence about it needs to hear this story and realize that with this implementation, it makes it very hard for anybody to credibly talk about restrictions that severely kneecap what small businesses are able to do compared to large businesses. And it all comes down to competition at the end of the day, and that's what fosters a good growing economy, and that's precisely what's happening in Alberta. But more on that in just a moment. First, just a word about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext, where you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to, starting for as little as a price of a cup of coffee a month, $2, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. Or for a little bit more, $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context Insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, with this, you're probably wondering what we're going to be doing with this. When we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on the topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And we also do have an option, a one-time PayPal option available at westerncontext.ca/support if you don't want to do monthly via Patreon, but nonetheless, the support is appreciated. We're just talking about the importance of competition in an open economy, and we're going to look at this from the Alberta perspective because Alberta tabled its yearly budget this week, and for the first time since 2014, Alberta tabled a balanced budget. And that budget in 2014 was projected to be balanced, but didn't end up being balanced at the end of the day because of the oil price collapse. And prior to this, we have to go back to 2008 to find a budget that was balanced in Alberta. Now, for those who voted for the UCP, this is another case of the government keeping their election promises, which still surprises many people to this day. The rate at which the UCP has implemented what they said they were going to do, and the fact that so many of the things on that list they've ticked off, it really just raises a lot of questions and underscores the whole idea about elections having consequences. And of course, what we're talking about, the questions that people were asking is, would the UCP actually be able to balance the budget in term one? Because of course, the UCP were elected on a platform of, as they said, protecting jobs, building pipelines, and growing the economy. The pipelines, of course, have been shut down numerous times, either by blockade or some projects were just deemed not financially feasible due to restrictions in other jurisdictions or actions taken by the Biden administration. But throughout all this, though, balancing the budget was also a priority. And with this, Alberta, going into the next fiscal year, is projecting a surplus of about $500 million, but this could be higher if resource values stay high or spending in the province falls. Surpluses of $900 million and $700 million are forecast for the following 2 years if the current spending track is maintained. Now, with this, the province will also provide upwards of an additional $100 million per year in targeted new spending to increase healthcare capacity. This includes things like new ICU beds to ensure that the system can respond to system-wide challenges from external forces, which, in other words, means that should there be another wave of COVID that requires more people to be admitted to hospital or ICU, the hope with expanding ICU and general hospital capacity is that restrictions won't be needed with that. And we've highlighted this time and time again over the last 2 years on this podcast that from the very start, it appeared as though that our healthcare system has had remarkably low capacity compared to other countries with both public and private healthcare systems. You can look to Europe for countries that have public systems and, of course, the US for their private systems. And one constant throughout all of that is that Alberta had benchmark low capacity per capita. Now, this will be addressed not only by new spending, but in the province's throne speech this week, combined with the capacity increases, the province will be looking to provide non-urgent surgeries in private clinics where feasible to take the strain off the public system. And at the end of the day, this has the net benefit of creating more spaces where procedures like hip and knee replacements can be done out of the public hospitals. And yes, for anybody wondering, these services will still be publicly funded. The general thought was that the UCP would need to embark on Ralph Klein-era hack-and-slash budgeting to reach this goal of balancing the budget, but thanks to global energy prices going up, that's not the case. There's also going to be a new initiative called Alberta at Work, and this initiative will provide more than $600 million that will build the skills of Albertans to grow the labor force in the province. $47 million of the Alberta at Work Fund will go towards capital funding, which means infrastructure, and $25 million over 3 years will be given to support collegiate programs and charter school expansions, creating pathways for students into higher learning and other in-demand career paths. Now, this creates school choice for many people who might not want to put their kids in the public school system, and this was yet again another of the UCP's election promises. Now, the big headline, of course, is that the budget is balanced with sky-high energy prices that we're seeing, but in reality, these prices were expected, and that is the price that the budget uses as its benchmark. Now, when looking at the budget, there's a general average oil price that the budget expects for the upcoming year. And the benchmark price that this budget uses is the price of $70 US West Texas Intermediate Oil to make its calculations. And this oil price has been hovering in the $80 to $90 range recently. But what's more, for 2022-2023, we can look at what the former NDP government did. And it's important to do this because they were saying that this budget is balanced purely based on energy prices. But looking back at their last budget, when they were elected in 2018, prior to being defeated, they were forecasting $63 barrel oil with a $6.7 billion deficit. And what's more, for this year, they also forecast the same price of oil that we're currently using in this budget. That's $70 per barrel oil. Now, it's a little bit obtuse and hard to understand this from the economic point of view, but University of Calgary economist Trevor Toome put together some wonderful graphs on Twitter showing where the money comes in and leaves from this budget. And he also projected where government spending and expenditures would be using the last fiscal update, looking at both the UCP spending track and the NDP spending track. Put simply, if the NDP were still in power and had the same revenue stream that the UCP has right now, and they were spending at the same levels at which they were when they were in government, we'd be seeing roughly $3 to $4 billion deficits going into 2023 under the NDP plan. For the whole of economy in Alberta, Alberta is still growing at north of 4% GDP per year. And in January, while Canada lost 200,000 jobs on the whole, Alberta gained more than 7,000. And that doesn't even begin to mention the 130,000 plus jobs that Alberta gained in 2021. There will, of course, be a time and place for a discussion on what needs to happen next to prevent the next oil downturn that will inevitably come from plunging Alberta back into deficit again. And the UCP government has talked about doing this. They highlight a strong and diverse economy that they say remains a central pillar with this budget of ensuring that doesn't happen. But there's also slated to be a revenue review panel happening this year where the province will look at ways to stabilize the general revenue stream. And we'll have more on that when it happens. But just to take a bit of a glimpse into the future of how this could look, it's entirely possible that we could face a fall referendum this year, or maybe a referendum with a general election next year, asking if Albertans want a 2-3% sales tax. This would bring in new revenue, but would also allow for some accounting on the taxation side. And the reason I say this is that if you examine the tax tables that are presented in the budget document, you'll see that the tax rates that the province uses, the income tax rates that the province uses above 10%, bring in about $1.2 billion worth of revenue, whereas the vast majority, more than 90% of that revenue, comes from the bulk 10% rate. So what this means is that if surpluses were sufficiently high or there was another source of revenue to offset, Alberta could return to its flat tax model that we had prior to 2014. Though whether or not this is needed is up for debate, of course, since even with this budget, Alberta remains the most tax-competitive province for both businesses and, of course, the overall tax burden for its citizens. The UCP was, of course, famously ribbed over its tax cuts, its corporate tax cuts, when they came into office and how fast they did them. But the corporate tax rate has fallen to 8%, and despite that tax rate going down, corporate tax revenues have continued to go up year over year since that tax cut. Looking at the actual Albertans now who pay into this government tax program, Albertans on the whole pay $10 billion less in sales taxes than those in Ontario, $12 billion less than those in Saskatchewan, and $8 billion less than those in BC. And for Ontario, Saskatchewan, and BC, overall, Albertans pay $14.8, $17.4, and $20.4 billion less in taxes than each of those provinces respectively. And those are just the lowest three and don't even begin to account for the provinces with higher tax rates. Now, for a family making $75,000 per year, this translates to Albertans saving over $1,400 a year over those in BC, $1,000 a year over those in Saskatchewan, and $3,800 more is saved than those in Ontario. That goes up if the family in question makes $150,000 per year to $4,900, $3,300, and $8,700 respectively. With this, the UCP has delivered on its core promise of balancing the budget in Alberta, and the economy is set to boom, barring any major shocks going forward. It's suffice to say at this point that the Alberta advantage is back.
Yes, and just looking at this budget, I think a lot of people would be surprised that coming out of the pandemic that the Alberta government was able to actually balance the budget again and to be able to make investments going forward, and that that would bring in more revenue without having to add in more taxes. And I think that's something that a lot of people would like to see from their governments, is to actually manage the province's finances in a way that requires them to not have to add in new taxes to make up for more spending. And that's something that we haven't really seen much from governments across Canada in the last few years, mainly because of the health challenges that have arisen, but also going back to a couple decades now, before we had the major recession in 2008 or the oil price collapse in early 2015. You know, these are things that had massive impacts on Canada and in Alberta in particular. So for things to go back into the green again for Alberta, this is a good thing going forward for the province, because it means that they're able to create new investment, but it also means that there's more money available in case there is an emergency that comes up that needs extra spending, or you know, there's contingencies available for things that need to happen. And that also means that there's more investment into programs that need to be done in Alberta. So it's a win-win for anyone, really, to have a balanced budget and to have a surplus that allows you to have that leeway going back and forward over the next few years. So we'll have to see if Alberta can keep it up going forward, and we'll have to hope that other provinces do the same as we move into another year.
Yeah, and you mentioned the term contingency. That's also important to note with this, that there's actually a $1.8 billion contingency fund built into this should there be some sort of major economic disaster, or should COVID come back in a way that people are not currently anticipating. So with that, we talked about a few weeks ago that if the government wanted, they could have made it an even bigger surplus, but $1.8 billion has been put into a contingency fund, and the surplus will be reinvested. It wasn't said in the budget, but the finance minister later said in questions that it'll be reinvested into the Alberta Heritage Fund. So the money will be invested into the future of Alberta, not necessarily directly put to spending to keep that spending ramping up, because that's one thing that the UCP government has tried to do since being in power, is they've tried to nudge Alberta's per capita spending down to its closest neighbor provinces, of course, being BC and Saskatchewan, but also Ontario and on the per capita level. And it's really quite interesting to look at the dueling pictures that we have, because we also have the BC budget this week.
Yes, in the exact same week as the Alberta UCP released their budget for the upcoming fiscal year, well, the BC NDP also released theirs. And for those thinking that there might be a bit of a contrast between the two, based on the wildly different approaches that the two political parties take on pretty much anything, well, you would be right in that they were very different. But unfortunately, those British Columbians looking for good news from the BC budget will likely be disappointed, as it forecasts higher taxes, lower small businesses investment, as well as revenue losses in the natural resource sectors, and even an undeserved pay hike for cabinet ministers that was kind of snuck in right near the end. Now, the budget was delivered by BC's Finance Minister, Selena Robinson, and Budget 2022 vows to take bold action to fight climate change, reduce the cost of living, and grow an inclusive and sustainable economy, in its own words. And if you're wondering, well, where have we heard this before? It's because we've pretty much heard variations on this theme all the way going back. And it's only when you get into the minutia and the actual spending do you actually see what the province is actually prioritizing. Now, the budget also promises new health spending and working towards that always promised $20 a day childcare. But what it doesn't actually do is balance the province's finances. And the NDP government is projecting deficits for the next several years, while the forecast shortfall for the current budget year has dropped by more than $9 billion. Now, due to better than expected economic growth fueled by an astonishing turnaround by the Insurance Corporation of BC, otherwise known as ICBC, as well as the continually sizzling real estate industry, which higher prices in that mean good news for the government because they tend to make more money off of that. Well, the new budget is forecast to end with a deficit of $483 million, which is down from a projected $9.6 billion last year. So, in a sense, they are moving in the right direction on that, but really it comes down to what's actually in the budget as to see whether they'll be moving forward to the green again. Now, the new budget is expected to have a deficit of $5.461 billion, and in addition, billions of dollars are set aside in contingencies as well, like we said earlier. Now, the province is going to be changing its sales tax rules as well, meaning that the PST will apply to more things, including used vehicle sales, in order to prevent what is being called tax avoidance. Now, the tax change for used vehicle sales was included in Tuesday's provincial budget and takes effect on October 1st. Now, at that time, the tax will apply to either the reported purchase price or the average wholesale price of that type and year of vehicle, whichever is greater. So that means that the price on the car, the tax is actually going to apply not to how much you sell it for, but for what the sticker price actually is. So oftentimes in used vehicle sales, that means that it's going to be much more than what you're actually getting back. So the PST is going to be charged not just 7% on your vehicle sale, but likely it's going to be a much higher percentage based on what the value actually is. So this means that if you're getting a car and then you're selling it within a few years, you're going to get double charged on the PST there. And well, that just means that the government is really making more money off of people that are selling used vehicles. Now, the budget says, quote, "This approach would align BC's treatment of private vehicle sales with the majority of other provinces and is intended to address tax avoidance arising from the underreporting of the price of motor vehicles from private sales. The measure will not apply for motor vehicles involved in a trade-in." Now, it also adds that for some reason that, quote, "individuals involved in private vehicle transactions are more likely to be low to medium income, living in a rural area, and male." So what that has to do with actually adding the tax on is, you know, remains to be seen. But Robinson was asked about the new used vehicle tax, and she said that it's not actually a new tax, it's just closing a loophole. But, you know, if the tax is there on something that didn't exist before, then, well, it is a new tax. And regardless of how you politically spin it, that is what it is. So when it comes down to it, people who sell used vehicles or make a living by flipping cars or by repairing older cars and then selling them for higher amounts after they've been fixed up, well, this is going to impact those individuals. So a lot of people who have side incomes doing that, well, it means that the government is coming after their cuts on the deal. Now, elsewhere in the budget news, the opposition BC Liberals have said that the cabinet ministers stand to gain 10% on their salaries that's normally withheld when the provincial government posts a deficit budget. And this is because the Liberals say that the New Democrats included a proposed amendment to the Balanced Budget and Ministerial Accountability Act that would give the ministers the extra pay despite posting a deficit. Now, Liberal House Leader Todd Stone says that while people in BC are struggling with rising costs, Premier John Horgan and his cabinet ministers are about to give themselves a pay rise. Now, Finance Minister Selena Robinson had defended the proposal, saying that the 10% holdback could be viewed as a deterrent to fund programs and policies that affect the budget. But as Todd Stone put it more bluntly and said, quote, fighting unaffordability is not one of the priorities of this budget, but what was one of the priorities was making life more affordable for the premier and for NDP cabinet ministers. So when it comes down to it, there is a law in the books in BC that says that if a government doesn't post a balanced or a surplus budget, then they aren't allowed to give themselves increase in pay for the cabinet as well as the premier. But they're trying to put in a proposed amendment to this that would take away that. And given that the NDP have a majority government, it's likely that it's going to pass. And we have to wonder who's going to hold our politicians to account for voting to give themselves more money. So we'll have to see how that shakes out in the media going forward. Now, the budget also includes a projected $700 million drop in revenue for the forestry industry. And while the budget tries to blame this on the reduction in old growth forest logging, which, of course, has been in the news quite a bit in BC over the last year and a half, specifically surrounding the Fairy Creek protests on Vancouver Island, it's hard to say really how much of this has to do with the old growth forest logging, given how much we've detailed in the past how little of BC's forests actually is old growth. Now, the government also tries to attribute the revenue drop to other factors, including in, quote, assumed decrease in lumber prices from the historically high levels experienced in 2021. But when it comes down to it, the really insanely high levels in 2021 was a blip, and they shouldn't have been basing their revenue based on such a high level that was pretty much unsustainable. Now, the government also expects a reduced harvest from Crown land as a result of a recent court finding that provincially authorized resource exploitation has infringed the treaty rights of the Blueberry River First Nations. Now, the Blueberry River First Nation is located just north of Fort St. John, and anyone who knows about the Peace River country knows that forestry is a very big very big deal in that sector of the province because of how little other economic opportunities there are. So many people are involved in the forestry industry up there, and well, this means that there's going to be much less opportunity for that. But in reality, when it all comes down to it, there really isn't that much that is positive for everyday British Columbians in this budget. It feels more like a let's continue to get through this budget like we saw in the previous couple of years or so, rather than a bright outlook for 2022-2023. So with more taxes on the way, along with lower revenues, it looks like things aren't going to be any more affordable in BC for everyday British Columbians in the upcoming year as we go forward.
And the interesting part about this is, of course, you can compare the huge spike in natural resources revenue that Alberta is experiencing, and that's fine. But there's also a general different trend where the spending in BC is going up, and most of the tone of what we're seeing in the BC budget seems to be geared around more of an attitude of, in effect, of spending on services rather than using the budget as an economic tool to grow the economy. And as we've talked about many times before on the podcast, there's a night and day difference between budgets and government policy that is based on economic principles versus one that is just based on spending on services and, in effect, purchasing new things. It really underscores how important the idea of running a government from the economic perspective is, and we're seeing this here in two different perspectives, both from Alberta and BC this week.
Yeah, exactly. There's two different approaches here, where Alberta's trying to grow the economy and make things more affordable for businesses to be able to operate, and while there's always a lot of criticism surrounding corporate tax cuts and other certain things like cutting red tape, there is an undeniable effect that that has on consumers when it comes down to the end of the day, because more companies that are able to operate means that there are more jobs in the province, which means, you know, there's more people making money. And when it comes down to it, the better tax rates in Alberta do give that out advantage on other provinces surrounding them with the lack of provincial sales tax, for instance. So when we look at BC, we're seeing more taxes on things, even if it's just something as simple as used vehicle sales taxes. We're seeing taxes on other things that really didn't get mentioned very much in the media. There wasn't really much of a deep dive into what was going on. It was only really talked about in general terms, and no one's really mentioned what these different finances will actually do to the province. And I think that that's something that the media could have done a bit more this week in trying to delve into how this will actually impact British Columbians going forward, because we're seeing now other provinces are starting to, you know, see that light at the end of the tunnel. And we're seeing in BC that, well, it's not really that case. They're still spending a lot on all of their different projects that they had promised on. And what this means is that there's more taxes on that. And as we're seeing with inflation happening in BC, quite a bit higher than most other provinces around the country, it means that things are getting more and more unaffordable. And if you don't have money, that's a big problem, because if you don't have that, then it means that the taxes that you're going to have to pay are a little bit higher, because these things actually impact lower income people more than higher income people who are able to weather those taxes. So when it comes down to it, we're seeing from a BC budget something that isn't really that friendly to consumers going forward, and not that friendly to average British Columbians. And I think that's something that's a bit of a disappointment this week.
Yeah, and all the BCers need to do is look to the Alberta budget, and it shows right there. Assuming a family makes $75,000 a year, those in BC will be paying $1,400 more per year in taxes to the BC government than they would be if they were in Alberta. And that highlights one of the huge stories of the BC budget that you're not going to find in the BC budget. But, of course, taxes are something that is everywhere in life, and in our firing line, we're going to be talking about a story that was not covered at all in the Canadian media. Of course, the firing line is a segment where we just do that, talk about stories that were not covered at all, or talk about stories that were covered in a way that completely misses the point. And since we're doing the former here, we're going to be talking about the digital services tax that the Canadian government wants to bring in. And one of the bills that died when Parliament was dissolved last summer for the election was the Canadian Digital Services Tax. And what this means is it is effectively putting a tax on things like Netflix, other streaming services, and digital purchases made on platforms like Amazon, Apple, or Google. Now, the tax would amount to about 3% on revenues earned by large companies that sell any digital service to Canadian users, or if the sale of Canadian user data is involved. So with that, Facebook also comes to mind. Now, most of the news this week, of course, has been really focused on Ukraine and the invasion by Vladimir Putin into that country. But before that, the media was talking about the revocation of the Emergencies Act. And despite all that, and despite everything our governments are focused on, this story of the U.S. threatening tariffs if we impose our own digital services tax got zero traction whatsoever this week. And that's important, because we need to realize that we're sitting next to one of the biggest economies in the world. And if the U.S. says they're going to consider imposing tariffs on Canada, we'd better take a good look at why that is, and if it's anything we're doing wrong, or if it's anything that the U.S. is doing wrong. Now, this story appeared in the Wall Street Journal, and various tech outlets, and Reuters also picked it up, and anybody who has a Globe and Mail subscription might have also seen it online as they reposted the Reuters story with that. In particular, in the Wall Street Journal, it says that the U.S. on Tuesday urged Canada to abandon its plan to impose a digital service tax on large businesses, warning that Washington could examine all options under bilateral trade agreements and domestic law to retaliate if such a levy is adopted. Now, the term retaliate applied by the U.S. on an economy that's the size of our own should make everybody reconsider what we're doing, and at the very least, look into this story to see just what the heck is going on. Now, we were long told that the so-called trade war between Canada and the U.S. was the fault of the Trump administration, but we need to face it that things didn't get better under Joe Biden, and could, if this tax is implemented, get worse than what we're facing right now. Now, Canada's imposing this tax because the Canadian government of Justin Trudeau and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland hope that everybody globally will implement a similar tax on these large tech companies. An international system of taxes on digital goods would create a level playing field, they say. But as we know with free market economics, the US, one of the world's biggest economies, isn't necessarily bound by that and what the will of the many want, and can effectively with this just do whatever they want. If Canada were to adopt such a tax with the others, it would just make digital investment more favorable in the US. The US is, of course, concerned because Canadian companies are exempt, while the US feels that American companies providing similar services are singled out. And for anybody who knows how the CRTC works and what the Ministry of Culture is about in our federal government, of course, in Canada, this is the CanCon, Canadian content, that's always talked about, ensuring that the CRTC regulates well enough so that a portion of all programming that Canadians see on TV and now on streaming services is going to be Canadian for cultural reasons, as they say. And of course, this plays well in certain parts of the country, like Quebec, and in other parts of the country, people just nod along and accept it because, in their point of view, having Canadian content is always good. Now, Canada will implement the tax if the OECD, the what is effectively known as the Group of Developed Countries, does not implement a similar tax by January of 2024. The US, in October, withdrew tariff threats against five European countries over a similar tax in an effort to, as they say, provide an option for such a global tax option. But now we need to ask, if they're not looking at imposing tariffs on these five European countries, why is this still on the table in Canada, with Canada? Now, to do this, we have to go back a month to January in another article that really only gained traction in the US that says that similar concerns about bilateral trade disputes between Canada and the US on steel and lumber are also at play. And with this, you have to look at other things we talked about going back to 2021 and 2020, in that there have been trade disputes under both the Trump and Biden administration regarding steel and lumber that haven't been resolved despite there being a new NAFTA deal in play. And you would think that with everything going on in the world, the turbulent nature of the world economy, as we've seen over the past few weeks with the ramping up of tensions in Ukraine, what China's been up to, you would think that Canada and the US would want to have a very smooth and very two-way bilateral trade relationship and resolve these issues on steel and lumber as quick as they can, but that hasn't happened yet. Now, Canadians also need to know what's at stake when it comes to these trade relationships. Somebody needs to ask the question, does it make sense to risk the US imposing tariffs, which is an economy way bigger on our own, so that the government of Canada can impose a 3% tax on tech giants? Does that make sense? Does it make sense to hurt the entire economy over a 3% tax on these tech giants? And with that, do people want to have Netflix and other streaming services go up even more in price than they already have? And to do this, we have to go back to the 2015 election when Justin Trudeau was first campaigning to be prime minister. And everybody laughed about this back then, but the Conservatives ran an ad with Stephen Harper at the front talking about his favorite Netflix TV shows, saying that if Justin Trudeau did get a majority government, a Netflix tax would eventually arise, and people laughed at it. Now, I doubt anybody imagined what amounts to a Netflix tax, or more broadly a streaming services tax, would be putting a strain on the US, a strain that we don't need, but lo and behold, here we are. This is something that the Canadian government could resolve tomorrow if they wanted to. But for some reason, the Canadian media didn't pick this up, and that's why this is our firing line this week.
I think that's the funny thing about this, is because it's for some reason that Canadian media didn't pick this up. But when you look into the ownership of the Canadian media, a lot of them are owned by the same sorts of companies that also show Canadian media online, as well as on TV and on radio, and oftentimes the newspapers and what's actually the news programs on TV, they're all owned by the same companies that are providing the Canadian content that the CRTC is regulating. So it's actually in their best interest to not actually talk about this story and to bury it because, well, they don't really have any benefit of actually talking about it, because if they talk about it more, that means that they have to admit that the Canadian government is actually giving them money to, in essence, not have any competition on this. So the big companies, once again, much like our earlier story about the small business relief program, the big companies are getting more money on this, whereas the smaller ones are not able to compete with them. And, you know, this is why this story was completely unheard of in the Canadian media, and why it was the international media that we had to turn to actually get the story on this. Because, you know, if it's, it seems to be that this digital service tax is something that the government is trying to dress up in flowery language and say that they're protecting Canadian values and Canadian culture. But at the end of the day, it's a tax. And that just means that people are going to be paying more money, because as we've seen with taxes in the past, all that does is trickle down to the consumers, who end up paying more for the same product. And when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, if there is action from the U.S. government, if we put the digital services tax in, well, that means that there's going to be more more problems with consumers going forward, because it means that we're going to be paying even more than what the 3% is going to actually get back from the revenue. And well, at the end of the day, this is something that we've seen from the federal government in the past, trying to say something and to put forward a policy that sounds good on paper until you actually look into it and find out that it has devastating consequences for Canada. And if anything is a hallmark of the Trudeau administration, it should be that policies that sound good, but then you'll actually look into it and find out they're actually not very good at all.
And with that, we've seen so many of these, and we could have talked about the fact that the Prime Minister was willing to go to an election over the invocation of the Emergencies Act, and not even 48 hours after the Emergencies Act is pushed away. We don't need it anymore. We could also talk about the various sanctions, as we mentioned, being put on Russia as a result of their invasion into Ukraine. We could have talked about that this week. All these stories make sense for Western context and make sense to be talked about from the angles they weren't being talked about. But we need to point out that there are these huge blind spots in the media that people just don't see, and that's why we do this show. And there's a lot of disagreement in this country right now between various governments and various people. And with that, I think we can move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is discord, which is defined as a disagreement between different groups. And well, we're seeing a lot of discord in the news this past week, what with the bigger stories getting more of the attention of discord between, Vladimir Putin and Ukraine. But we're also seeing a lot of discord in between different types of groups in Canada, businesses and consumers and on one end, and governments on the other, when it comes to different taxes going forward, either with the small business relief program that mainly went to large corporations, budgets that either released tax burden on their citizens or increased it, or we're also seeing different discord between the U.S. and Canada when it comes to the tax that is being put forward by Justin Trudeau on digital services. So discord seems to be something that's happening a lot this week, not just abroad, but in Canada as well. And that is why discord is our word of the week this week.
Yeah, it's a good way to sum up everything that we've talked about, both in terms of how the stories have been presented for the Alberta and BC budgets, also the initial disagreements about what kind of pandemic aid should go around. We're starting to see the numbers behind some of that, and also just the very big disagreements between Canada and the U.S. on trade disputes that, given everything happening in the world, should just be resolved at this point. given the fact that we have such a wonderful history between these two countries. There's no reason both stakeholders just shouldn't put their back into it and have a bit of a discussion over that sooner rather than later. But of course, you can read more about this story and all the other stories we talked about this week in our supplementals at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, and more. You can find all that at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where you can find us at Western Context. We post the shows and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week. With that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media is talking about and a lot of the uncovered stories that really don't get mentioned as much as they should, whether they're in TV, print, radio, TV, or online. We will find them and give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. With that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.